From Vermont to Kentucky, South Dakota to New Mexico, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, abolishing ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, is a rallying cry for the left. But how would such a move affect national security? Fred Lucas of the Daily Signal is here with the answer. The Florida primary yielded a classic conservative versus liberal matchup for the general election and gave Republicans a U.S. Senate pickup opportunity. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. Federal courts have thrown congressional races in North Carolina into chaos by invalidating district lines. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks about how parties can fix the redistricting process before the next census. And Hillary Clinton railed against the separating of families at the border, yet appeared at a rally in support of abortion, which permanently separates families. Dr. Paul Kengor from Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, better known as ICE, is tasked with enforcing our nation's immigration laws. That has made it a target of vitriol from the left, which opposes many of President Trump's immigration policies. Here to discuss ICE and the role it plays in national security is Fred Lucas. Fred is the White House correspondent for the Daily Signal, which is an electronic publication of the Heritage Foundation. Fred, welcome to American Radio Journal. Fred, there's been a lot of discussion about ICE. Tell us what it is and what the agency is responsible for doing.
Well, ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, was actually, it's a fairly young agency. It started after 9/11 as part of the what was then the new Department of Homeland Security. Previously, the INS, Immigration and Naturalization Services, which no longer exists, combined both naturalization and enforcement actions. The 9/11 Commission and various studies after that had determined that one of the reasons that this terrorist attack was allowed to happen is that there wasn't enough immigration enforcement. So a new agency itself was started, and that's how we ended up with ICE. And it's hadn't been quite so controversial up until Trump came along. Now you've got a lot of people on the left who are calling for abolishing ICE.
You raise an interesting point, which is ICE was created as a reaction, as a result of terrorist attacks. Talk just a little bit more, Fred, about the national security implications of ICE. There's a lot of talk about how it rounds up illegal immigrants, but there's sort of a larger role here, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. Our story about this on the Daily Signal gives a lot of stats, and I encourage people to read that. ICE is not just focused on immigration. That's a big part of it, but under that umbrella of illegal immigration, they go after terror suspects. They go after, for that matter, a lot of it is human smuggling, drug smuggling. So those are major targets for ICE as well.
When it comes to the issue of drugs and drug smuggling, particularly across the southern border, under the Trump administration, has ICE ramped up its efforts, or is that component been on a steady course?
Yeah, they've definitely ramped up their efforts quite a bit. We've got the numbers in the story that shows it's almost doubled from what it was in the previous fiscal year after Trump came into office from what Obama was. So yes, I mean, there's been both going after illegal immigrants, but also going after the human trafficking and the drug trafficking aspect, and also arrest of people who were in the country for terrorism reasons.
ICE, of course, gets most of its publicity, most of the news coverage that follows it over the apprehension of illegal immigrants, usually to be deported. Unfortunately, a number of them have committed crimes. Recently, there was a story about ICE having apprehended an individual who had been a Nazi war criminal and sent him back.
Right.
So ICE is not simply limited to dealing with immigrants from the southern border, is it?
Not at all. And we actually had a separate piece on the Daily Signal, which I also encourage folks to read, that looks into a history of going back since ICE came into being, looks at how they have made arrest of these Nazi war criminals and led to deportation. There's been about four or five cases of this.
Fred, let's talk a bit about the minority community here in our country. And in your article on the Daily Signal, you did delve into the impact that ICE has in protecting the minority community and what would happen if ICE wasn't there. So talk a little bit about that.
On the left, there is a lot of desire, I think, to play identity politics on this, and particularly even with law enforcement. But I interviewed Matthew Albence. He is the number two guy right now with ICE, who talked a great deal about how ICE has received a great deal of appreciation from minority communities and immigrant communities. The reason why is these neighborhoods don't want drug dealers, human smugglers in their neighborhoods any more than anyone else would. The very unfortunate thing for immigrant communities and minority communities that when these illegal criminal aliens come across the border and sneak into the country, they ensconce themselves to blend in. They try to blend in, of course, and so they move into the communities where they think they won't be noticed or they're not particularly wanted either. And so these communities, they appreciate when ICE makes these arrests and takes them out of the communities.
If ICE were abolished, Fred, where would that leave us? Who would handle this function were that to occur?
Well, that's the ultimate question, because right now it's just kind of a bumper sticker feel-good slogan for some people on the left, but they're not really saying who would pick up these tasks. One answer might be to create another federal agency to do this, but then you're just basically renaming ICE if you do that. You could split off the more non-controversial aspects of ICE. No one's against going after human smuggling, drug trafficking, and terrorism, or no one should be against going after those things. But if you did that, that would create another bureaucracy, and it would be quite expensive. So it doesn't make a lot of sense what they're saying, and no one's really explained this. They haven't given and then what follow-up as to. They've just basically carried the signs and protests. And a handful of congressmen have introduced bills, but in explaining their rationale behind this, they've usually just gone after the Trump administration.
We have been talking with Fred Lucas. Fred is the White House correspondent for the Daily Signal, an electronic publication of the Heritage Foundation. Fred, tell us a little bit more about the Daily Signal. Also, if folks would like to read more about this issue and all the many issues covered by the Daily Signal, how can they access that?
Please go to dailysignal.com, and we are the multimedia news outlet for the Heritage Foundation, and it's really a bigger concentration on policy than politics. We take deep dives into the issues of the day.
Fred Lucas of the Daily Signal. Fred, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth has, of course, been keeping an eye on all the state-by-state primaries that have been taking place for the last few months. We're just about to the end of them. Two big ones this past week, Florida and Arizona. We're going to talk about the results. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Hillman.
Let's start out with Florida. A big upset in the governor's race. Now, we normally with the club talk about the federal races. We will do that as well. But in the governor's race, a conservative congressman, now the nominee. This sets up quite an interesting general election, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was a thing of beauty, to be honest with you. Adam Putnam was considered the favorite. He had spent the last probably 15, 20 years prepping for this day. He's very much an establishment politician. He was in Congress for a while, and then he became the ag secretary in Florida and then a few other things. And he raised just millions and millions of dollars. And then DeSantis comes in, who is just a congressman that very few people knew in Florida on the East Coast by Jacksonville. And he comes in there very conservative. The Club for Growth PAC, the group that I work for, we endorsed him when he first ran for the House and then when he ran for the Senate last year, but then backed out when Rubio decided to run for re-election. And then Trump endorsed DeSantis, and that was basically game over. DeSantis has now won the nomination for the governor's race for the Republicans, and he'll face off against a Democrat in the fall. I think that Democrats think they have a shot at maybe winning this, but in the end, I still believe that DeSantis is going to be the heavy favorite.
Is not the Democrat an ultra-left-wing sort of out of the Democrat-socialist mold of Bernie Sanders?
Very much so. In fact, he had a contentious primary as well, And his opponent was Gwen Graham, the daughter of former Senator Bob Graham, and she always portrayed herself as a centrist. She was in the U.S. House for a short bit and tried to portray herself as that. So Andrew Gillum, the gentleman that won the Democrat primary, he ran to the left of her and was very far left in his views, and he clearly won the Democrat primary. Now he'll have a very difficult time, I think, pivoting to the center to try and pick up independent votes. So Florida is a conservative state. They have elected Republican governors in the past with Rick Scott and Jeb Bush. I anticipate it's going to stay that way.
Speaking of Rick Scott, we have a U.S. Senate race in Florida this year. This is a pickup opportunity for Republicans, correct?
Yes. Rick Scott only recently got into this race, but because of his personal wealth and just his hard-nosed campaigning, he has quickly made this competitive. In fact, I think most people view this as his race to lose. Bill Nelson has been in Congress for a long time, been in the Senate for a long time. He's getting up there in age. He doesn't have the energy and the stamina that Rick Scott has. Scott won his primary easily. I'm not even sure he had an opponent. He's clearly going to outspend Nelson. So when you have DeSantis at the top of the ticket, Rick Scott right underneath him, those two opportunities, I think, will be victorious by November.
Also, a number of contested races for seats in the House of Representatives in Florida. Can you give us a bit of an overview on what happened there?
Yeah, there was a race to replace DeSantis in his seat in Florida 6. We didn't get involved there, but a Republican who should vote pretty well won that nomination. I don't think he'll be as good as DeSantis was in the House, but he'll be pretty good. In Florida 17, Tom Rooney retired, and the Club for Growth PAC endorsed Greg Stube in that race. Stube won the primary overwhelmingly. I think he had over 60%. He's going to be fantastic. That's a name to remember. He is not only going to vote well, but he's going to be a fighter. So watch out for him. Then there was a race down in Miami that I think Democrats will likely pick up. It was held by a Republican, but because it's sort of a purple district, I think Democrats have a shot at that. So overall, I think that when you look at the governor's race, the Senate race, and the Stube race, there's a lot to be hopeful for going forward.
Let's go across the country now to Arizona, which, of course, has been the focus of a lot of attention this past week with the passing of Senator John McCain. But there was already an open U.S. Senate seat in Arizona. Tell us who got nominated in that race.
Well, the Democrats have consolidated their support around Kyrsten Sinema, and she portrays herself as a centrist. She's very photogenic. She's very charismatic. She's a very good fundraiser. She will be very formidable, even in a red state like Arizona. The Republicans nominated Martha McSally. I don't believe she's that much of a conservative. She's tangled with Trump in the past, although she's now realized that her fortunes ride with Trump. But she's a good fundraiser. She's a good candidate. So that will be a very, very competitive Senate race. The other Senate seat, now vacant because of the passing of John McCain, that will result in an appointment by the Republican Governor Doug Ducey. What's interesting here, a reporter tweeted something out recently about, he joked that Arizonans better like political ads because there will be 5 cycles of Senate races between last year's or the 2016 race. Then there's going to be one this year, obviously, with McSally versus Sinema. Then the appointed senator to replace McCain will be up in 2020. And then, of course, the regular cycles of 2022 and 2024 are going to be up for grabs as well. So there's going to be a lot going on in Arizona over the next several years regarding these Senate seats.
Relative to Senator McCain's seat, of course, with his funeral services and everything being concluded over the course of the next few days or weeks, we would expect a gubernatorial appointment to that seat. How exactly does that work, and are any names surfacing?
There are a lot of names, so it's very difficult to speculate. But what's probably most important is that the governor is a conservative, And I think he truly wants to appoint a conservative to this seat. McCain, he was certainly an independent senator. There were some very bad things in his record, like McCain-Feingold, his hostility towards political free speech. He was the deciding no vote in an Obamacare repeal. But he was very good on opposing earmarks and a lot of government spending. Overall, though, his record was not as conservative as what we expect will be his replacement. So I think when it comes to conservatism, I think the Senate will be more conservative with his replacement. We should find out that name shortly. They will serve until 2020 as an incumbent, and that means that the Supreme Court nomination that Trump put forward, Kavanaugh, will likely breeze through now that we have an extra vote. I'm not too worried that that confirmation is going to get rejected. And then if the Senate is able to pick a couple of other seats in November, then the GOP may be able to take another crack at Obamacare repeal.
Well, we have an ever-changing landscape in Washington, D.C. and across the country. Keeping an eye on all of that for us is Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. And Andy, tell us a bit about the club.
Sure thing. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, and from all 50 states in the Union, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Once again, federal courts have stepped in to invalidate congressional district lines, this time in North Carolina. With the 2020 census looming and redistricting in all 50 states to follow, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine takes a look at redistricting reform. Eric?
A three-judge panel has ruled for the second time this year that North Carolina's congressional districts are unfairly gerrymandered to give Republicans an electoral edge and that they must be redrawn before the election in November. The decision has thrown crucial congressional races into chaos, and quite frankly, we don't know exactly what's going to happen right now. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at North Carolina's redistricting mess and at trying to work through not just the problems that have been created in North Carolina and other states where gerrymandering is prevalent, but also maybe how we might be able to put some limitations or even try to fix this problem. Now, this ruling out of North Carolina on Monday has really created problems because the primary elections have already taken place there for these congressional races. The general elections are supposed to be held in November, but all of a sudden the districts don't exist anymore, and the state legislature has been given until mid-September to redraw them. And there's probably not any remedy from a higher court, because if you appeal this decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, well, it could very well end up deadlocked 4-4 given the current makeup, and certainly wouldn't get resolved before November one way or the other. So there are a lot of things still up in the air in North Carolina. But the craziness of this and the fact that judges threw out these districts just 70 days before a general election doesn't necessarily mean that that decision is wrong. After all, if the congressional districts are indeed unlawful, they really shouldn't be used for any election, no matter how disruptive it might be to remedy them. But the problem here is really that line between an unfair district and an unlawful district is pretty blurry, and it really depends on the eyes of the beholder. So let's start with what's most obvious, what we can definitely know, and that is that North Carolina's districts are indeed slanted to favor Republicans. This is pretty much beyond doubt. Prior to a Republican-controlled redistricting in 2011, Democrats held 8 of the state's 13 seats in Congress. But on the first election held in the new map, Republicans won a 9-4 majority in the state's congressional delegation, even though Democrats actually received more votes in aggregate, and Republicans have since extended their lead. They now have a 10-3 majority in North Carolina's congressional delegation. Such is the power of redistricting, because by packing parts of the state with high concentrations of Democratic voters into just a few pretty odd-shaped districts, Republican mapmakers have been able to give their candidates an edge in other parts of the state. And maybe the best example of this is the old North Carolina 12th District. It was a serpentine monstrosity, more than 200 miles long, but never more than about 20 miles wide. One statistical analysis of the compactness of congressional districts rated it as either the first or second most gerrymandered district in the entire country, depending on which measurement you use. So everyone agrees that North Carolina was pretty heavily gerrymandered by Republicans in 2011, but that in and of itself, it's important to remember, is not necessarily illegal. Redistricting is a fundamentally political process, and state legislators and courts have been pretty unwilling to put objective limits on just how much partisan influence is okay. Now, there are legal limits when gerrymandering affects racial minorities, and it was actually on those grounds that a federal judge in 2016 threw out North Carolina's 1st and 12th districts, that infamous 12th district. Redrawing those districts required shifting some others around, but the resulting map ended up drawing another legal challenge because there were critics who claimed that it still unfairly boosted Republican candidates' chances. In January, a panel of three federal judges ruled that the new map would also have to be redrawn before this year's election. That eventually went to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court in June declined to make a decisive ruling about North Carolina, and instead they kicked it back down to the lower court, and that is where we got this decision on Monday, was a reaffirmation from the lower court that indeed this map has to be redrawn. In writing for the majority on Monday, Judge Jim Wynn wrote that the Constitution should not allow elected officials to enact laws that distort the marketplace of political ideas so as to intentionally favor certain political beliefs, parties, or candidates and disfavor others. But by ordering the state legislature to come up with a new district map before mid-September, the judges have kind of created their own distortions here. Candidates standing for the election in just 70 days now have no idea in which districts they reside, and neither do voters. So what do we make of all this? I think there should be little sympathy for Republicans who claim that partisanship overturned their previously pretty partisan efforts to influence the outcome of the election. Still, the possibility that judicial oversight of redistricting could become just another level in this endlessly partisan game is also pretty worrying. Should the fairness of congressional districts really depend on which set of judges is looking at them or who appointed those judges? That's not a solution here. And while Republican-drawn gerrymanders in places like North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania have drawn the most attention in the media and the courts this year, Democrat-drawn maps in 2011 were actually less compact and more gerrymandered on average, according to various statistical analyses of different states. I think North Carolina's ongoing redistricting crisis demands, again, just like similar crises in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, it really demands that both major parties agree to some sort of objective, measurable limit on partisan gerrymandering. We have statistical measures now, like those that identified the old North Carolina 12th as the nation's worst gerrymandered district. And those statistical measurements can be part of the solution, and so can overlaid data about electoral outcomes, things like the efficiency gap measure, which was at the center of the Wisconsin redistricting case that went to the Supreme Court earlier this year. Now, each of these measurements has its limits, and any sort of standard that you set would be somewhat arbitrary by nature. But without even attempting to place those limitations, these partisan fights over redistricting are only going to get worse, because we're going to have to go through all of this again with the next scheduled redrawing of all congressional districts after the 2020 census. The current redistricting process leaves voters, I think, confused at best and disenfranchised at worst. It also invites partisanship into the legal system, and it produces congressional majorities that do not always reflect the will of the people. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle should recognize that this is a problem, and we now have the tools to write some pretty simple rules for this ugly political game. So state lawmakers should seize the opportunity to do that. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of redistricting and everything else we're working on this week at Reason.com. I'll be right back here next week with a guest on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Left-wing activists were up in arms over the separation of families at the southern border, yet support abortion, which permanently separates children from their parents. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary.
Hillary Clinton recently pulled off a striking display of moral hypocrisy. Right after excoriating Donald Trump's horrific policy toward children of illegal immigrants, she flew to Ireland to praise Ireland for legalizing the killing of unborn children. Tears of gratitude filled Hillary's eyes as she thanked Irish millennials for embracing abortion. Speaking to a crowd in Dublin, Hillary spoke of how her heart had been warmed from afar by the image of Irish people flying home to vote for abortion from all over the world. "What a triumph for youth, for human rights, and for good government," marveled Hillary as she held forth in the literal name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Yes, Clinton spoke those words at no less than Ireland's Trinity College. University officials there bestowed her with an honorary degree, which she employed as a platform to reverence Ireland's great new triumph, abortion. In all, it was quite a departure from the tears of sadness that Hillary had emoted at the start of the week back home at a women's event in New York. There, she torched President Donald Trump for his policies toward children of illegal immigrants. "What is happening to families at the border is horrific," Clinton remonstrated. "Every human being with a sense of compassion and decency should be outraged. We watch President Trump," she said, "with broken hearts." Her remarks at the Women's Forum in New York awards lunch were followed up by a tweet later that Monday afternoon where she wrote, quote, "Every parent who has ever held a child in their arms, every human being with a sense of compassion and decency should be outraged by the Trump policy." If only Mrs. Clinton, not to mention other pro-choice liberals, applied a sense of compassion and decency to unborn babies. Flip her statement around and try to imagine her making that exact same statement, except about children in the womb. Think about it. Every parent who has ever held a child in their arms, every human being with a sense of compassion and decency, should be outraged by abortion. In fact, fill in that blank for any number of types of abortion going back to the 1990s when Hillary was first lady, to her years in the Senate, to her time in the Obama administration, to the 2016 presidential campaign when there wasn't a form of legalized abortion that Mrs. Clinton wouldn't back. Remember the exchange during her 2016 presidential debates with Donald Trump? It was the third and final debate, and the moderator, Fox News Channel's Chris Wallace, asked Clinton, quote, "You've been quoted as saying that the fetus has no constitutional rights, Mrs. Clinton. You also voted against a ban on late-term partial birth abortion. Why?" Well, I personally could have written Clinton's response, having heard it so many times over the years. She said, quote, "Because Roe v. Wade very clearly sets out that there can be regulations on abortion so long as the life and health of the mother are taken into account and blah, blah, blah." Same old Hillary. You get the idea. Donald Trump's response to Hillary was spot on. Said Trump, "Well, I think it's terrible. If you go with what Hillary is saying, in the ninth month, you can take the baby and rip the baby out of the womb of the mother just prior to the birth of the baby. Now, you can say that's okay, and Hillary can say that that's okay, but it's not okay with me." Hillary, she got angry at that, scolding Trump for his scare rhetoric. Well, perhaps some of us would take Hillary Clinton and other liberals more seriously if, just once, they applied their oozing compassion for migrant children to unborn children. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President, on Ronald Reagan and John Paul II.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WGUO-FM in Houma, Louisiana, WBNL-AM in Boonville, Indiana, along with WRSG-FM in Middleborne, West Virginia. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.